I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's no transformation that doesn't begin without being able to tell the truth. You have to be able to be honest with yourself about who you are. I had to accept that I manipulated people because I was afraid of being seen. I was afraid of being the one who actually was the issue or had the issue, and that was the issue. You complete me, this like famous line, everyone thought it was so romantic, but it gives this idea that it is through your soulmate, your twin flame, this like piece of your soul that you find in another person. That language equates to that you're not complete without this missing piece. No matter your gender combination, the orientation to your partner as being a wise, brilliant being who can see you in a way you can't see you and is actually an invitation to your greatest evolution. If you start to see a relationship as a container for your liberation of where you get triggered, where you get stuck, where you need to heal, then you actually orient to the relationship from a place of being a gift. What is not integrated will be repeated. It's a lesson of life. We wonder why we do the same things, why we choose the same people. It's because we haven't excavated and stepped into the gold. I remember I had a mentor who I said, every time I feel like I learn something, the onion, I think I peel a layer of the onion and it's getting smaller, but it seems like it's getting bigger. And she said to me,
peeling it.
Yeah. And like, I'm going to find this like awakened core, you know? And she said to me, maybe instead you should orient to the idea that every time you understand something new, you actually expand and take up more space. And I was like, oh, well, that's a way better positive orientation, because yeah, you can never not get better at relationship. And that's not, I've been really thinking about this a lot lately. Like, the evidence that you need to grow or that you need to grow is not evidence of your lack of worth, but actually evidence of what you're capable of. And that's a different way of seeing
it's subtle, but it's profoundly different in terms of how you approach. Sorry, I've interrupted.
You're good, man. You're good.
I think it's yeah, I think it's extremely different when you start coming from the top down to the bottom up in terms of, well, especially feeling into your work, and it's I found it challenging to find a thread to start on, you know, because it goes so deep. And I guess we're here, and you know, I'm just going to riff with it, but you know, you refer to healing as the coming back to wholeness in many ways, but there's always that, you know, coming back to wholeness from a place of I'm great the way that I am and there's more to grow into, like you're describing, as opposed to, oh, I'm actually quite broken and I've got some things that I need to weld back together. Two very different approaches. And I used to try and evangelize one approach over the other, namely the empowered approach. Maybe there's a sense of maturity, or maybe I'm regressing in my growth. I'm not sure. But now I just find, you know, different times and different spaces, different things apply, your thoughts on the healing journey to wholeness?
Well, I think so much of the motivation of getting into growth or understanding relationships, let's say, for example, they come from a place of usually you hit an end, a bottom, something's not working. So I think the majority of us, just because there's not generally mature adults when we're younger, navigating how we see the world, we inherit their own lack of self-worth. We inherit how they relate to the world from a place of inadequacy. And so we just inherit that. And so, yeah, I think there's the way you come to growth is beautiful, no matter how you come to it. It's just that what you always discover eventually is that orienting to growth from a place of brokenness means you have to keep the identity that something needs to be fixed. And that actually is, I think, maybe at the core part of healing, because till then, even your personal growth is connected to and reinforcing an identity of suffering. And that's why what you're saying, I love it, because it's what brings you there. It's what brings you there. It's the thing that finally gets you to change. Like if someone you love leaves you and then you start changing because you want to get them back, at some point you have to let go of the idea of getting them back as the motivator, because then if you don't get them back, you won't keep the changes. So there's these really interesting subtleties, you know?
Brother, how did connection and relationships become such a central part of your work? And I guess I come to that from a loaded place. I'll be completely transparent. I've just found through the Inspired Evolution that people that are doing work as profound and as rich as yours generally have their own challenges that have formed their gifts to the world. So that's the baggage I bring to the question. I just want that. But yeah, how did relationships and connection become the center point of your work in the world, which is being widely celebrated and received at the moment? Yeah,
you know, I'd say I'm not the first. I wouldn't be this solo specimen that didn't develop the passion from just a passion. Yeah, it came from wounding. It came from pain. That idea of turning your mess into your message. And, you know, originally my obsession with wanting to understand people was because I was in sales. So I really wanted to understand how to get people to change their behavior. My first job ever was actually at an electronics store, which in Canada was called Future Shop. And it was actually, I'm not even exaggerating, it was a lot like the 40-year-old virgin. Like we wore suits, we sold extended warranties. I'm sure there was a 40-year-old virgin at the store. And they're like, we were nerdy electronics-y, you know, people. But I learned a lot. Like I was taught really aggressive sales tactics. You're put through hundreds of hours of all that stuff. And what was so valuable about it is that you had to learn how to build rapport with someone in 10 seconds. You know, you had to learn how to dance with their objections and handle them. And it made you really versed at conversing. It made you actually pretty skilled at dealing with your partner. But the problem was, is I was actually navigating, even the way I would have conflict with a partner was very manipulative, because I knew how to navigate them around a subject. And they were like, wait, how did this become my fault? And I'm like, well, I can't be blamed for how you feel, which was exactly, I was gaslighting. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just protecting myself from having to feel any form of unworthiness or that I wasn't showing up well. So that led to the end of my 20s, my late 20s. I was 27, and I went through an engagement ending. And I remember when that ended, she was an incredible woman, is an incredible woman. She was everything I was taught to want. And we were together for 5 years, and I was kind of living the classic story. Like you date a woman you meet in, let's say for my story, college, you get married by your late 20s, you have kids by 30, and you're on task. And I was right on task. And when I asked her to marry me, I didn't want to get engaged. But I was doing it because, you know, we were together a long time, and people told me that when you get engaged, all the anxiety will go away, or like, yeah, it's just what you're supposed to do.
Picket fence lane.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like just, sorry. And it's got the bumpers. You can't leave it, you know, without
that's the picket fence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. With spikes on it. But yeah, so
should have paid more attention. Sorry,
I shut up, please, seriously, please, should please, have please, paid more please, attention. Stop talking. But what was really fascinating was that when I went to people and say, like, I'm really afraid, they'd say, well, yeah, you're just a guy, like, you're afraid of commitment. And what angered me at that, because I eventually left the engagement, but what angered me was that we're told that men are supposed to, we want emotionally intelligent men. And when I was expressing my emotion and seeking it as a form of intelligence, I was told I didn't feel how I actually felt. There was no interest in exploring my feeling. It was just telling me that here you are, you're a man, you're just afraid. But it felt like so much more than that. And so I really wondered to myself, like, wow, like, I've never felt more connected to myself since I left this relationship. And why, in the moment that I feel most proud of myself, do I feel like people are actually most judgmental of me? That my relationship ended, that I couldn't get married, that I'm the one afraid of commitment, that I wasn't mature enough. And that was a strange paradox to hold, because I was like, well, surely relationships end and it's a positive thing. And so I started to actually see that society had taught me that you get married and you stay together forever and you're married and you die happy. But what I noticed was people were getting divorced all over the place, and people who were together for 40, 50 years, a lot of them didn't even like each other. So I thought, why am I so good at talking about everything but my feelings? Like, this isn't a skill set issue. There's something else going on here. So at the time I was in pharma, I was a pharmaceutical sales guy. And I was like, I'm going to dive deep into the research on relationships. I'm going to study, because I was trained in reading clinical trials, all the things. So I'm like, I'm just going to go deep in the research. And I went back to school, studied positive psychology, and started writing about what I was learning. And a lot of my writing actually just became an exorcism of my shame, because it was like, wow, I pursued short-term relationships, one-night stands. Why? What did I learn from that? What was I avoiding? So I started to share all the things I'd learned in my greatest mistakes, the things I was most ashamed of. And apparently people liked that. So people wanted to learn too, because I thought, why has no one taught this? Like, this makes no sense.
There's a couple of, thank you so much for sharing yourself, brother. Yeah. There's a couple of things in there. And I'll just point one out and then I'll ask a question on the next one. But also, as you were describing before, you know, just the, even your relationships from back in the tech store days, you having relationships on a surface level, being able to, again, just manipulate outcomes potentially just because of, you know, understanding human behavior. And yet I think there's this, because I think many people approach relationships from that perspective on a surface level, but yet there is still this yearning for like authentic kind of connection deeper beneath there. So there's a total, just wanted to, you know, place that in the conversation, because I'm sure as a seed it'll grow. But where you touched off is, I think, really important for us to dive deeper into, because the shame piece is a really, really interesting piece, because, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it, as like specifically, because from what I've come to learn, it's a bunch of projection.
Tell me more.
Well, I look at it as in, like, should I, like, are there parts of me that really, like, is there any part of me that I should really be ashamed of? If, you know, if I haven't really wronged anybody in any way, touch wood, like, you know, we walk around, even if we just look at how much energy, you know, and I've done this, shame people have carried around their bodies, right?
Right.
And it's, yeah, like, agreed. But your body, like, that's like, God gave you a body. Like, you've got a body, bro. Like, you've got, right, legs, you've got, right, arms, you've, right, got eyes. Like, shame, like, where does that come from? And it's like, well, I look at billboards and at athletes and models look like this and I don't look like that, so I'm ashamed. And there's this shame frequency. It's like, what? You're projecting on yourself, and other people are potentially, like, you're basically looking at yourself through other people's lens and then projecting back on yourself inadequacy, not enoughness, self-esteem stuff. So it seems to be a bit of a, my awareness of it is that it's a toxic mirage. But I'd love to help you, I'd love to have you help me clear that up in some ways, if it's not what you think, or, yeah, just what your thoughts on shame in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree, because I think at the core of what elicits that type of shame is the belief that this is evidence of my brokenness, right? Like, here's just more things, and I can go through the Rolodex of my history and pick out the ways I've hurt myself, I've hurt others. I would say, though, that I really do believe as a biological or psychological mechanism, shame can be healthy. So let me explain that, because Brené Brown would say that shame is you are something bad and guilt is you did something bad. But shame, if I knowingly, which it becomes knowing once you get the pain from it, but if I make a choice that causes harm to myself or another person, then it is natural that I'll experience shame. Because ultimately, moral shame, and I'm talking about my own moral compass, not projected upon me, which would be toxic shame. But if I actually make a choice that is out of alignment with my values, and that actual pain is inviting me to grow into my values, to make choices surrounding my values. So unintegrated. So like, if I make choices that cause me suffering, cause other people suffering, that means I'm not relating to myself as sacred, nor am I relating to others as sacred. Because what actually ends up creating the sacred reverence for myself is that through the learning, I actually change and grow. And if I fail to change and grow, like I keep repeating the same patterns, it now becomes a choice, not a mistake. And so I'm actually sitting on piles of wisdom, or I would call it knowledge. It's not wisdom yet because it's not integrated. So that's where I think what we might label as shame can actually be very helpful in recognizing that we are not actually tapping into the wisdom that we have, that through the things I'm most ashamed of are actually the opportunities for me to step more fully into an integrated human being who's paying attention to my values and my moral compass. And, you know, I don't think you're ever 100% in integrity, because you're always learning, which means you always have a chance to become better. And that's, I think, ultimately what life provides, if that makes sense.
It totally does. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Super helpful in the constructive space that it then holds for us. And you discern between shame and guilt. Can you open that up a little bit further? Guilt.
Well, I think how Brené Brown defines it is just so popularized. But I think guilt is very similar to healthy shame, in that I did something wrong. I feel bad for what I did. And that version of toxic shame is when what I did wrong is actually tied to my identity. You know, and I remember doing, years ago, I remember doing this meditation, and I felt like I judged a lot of bros, you know, like, I'll call it like frosted tips, you know, like Jagerbomb kind of dudes, finance kind of guys. Which, let me just point out, if you are listening to this or watching this and you're like, F you, I had frosted tips. I had a puka shell necklace, and my undergraduate degree specialized in finance. So when I say that, what I'm saying is that I was judging most what I had not yet forgiven. And I remember doing this meditation where I had worked through the shame I had about how I'd shown up, et cetera, at that time in my life. And I could feel the 21-year-old version of me re-enter my body, because he was welcome again. And, you know, the things that we're most ashamed of in the Rolodex of our life, we tend to reject those parts of ourselves. And what happens is if you reject or are not willing to look at the circumstances that you've been in your life, whether you're a victim of them or not, because none of this is negating the experience of victimization, but it's to say, if I reject the experience, then I actually reject the lesson. And then I'm not able to relate to people who are like the younger version of myself. So for me, to be fully in integrity with the work that I do, my commitment to myself is that I have to explore every single thing I don't want to look at, especially the things I don't want to look at. And then I have to excavate them for the wisdom and the knowledge that is actually being asked to be derived from it. And I think a lot of it, like the process of alchemy, in that There's a saying that I remember Francis Weller, who's a psychotherapist, and he calls himself a soul activist. He's amazing. And he said, alchemy doesn't care about the alchemist. Like, the actual process of change doesn't care about your feelings. Like, it just wants you to become better. And so I think about that a lot when I think about the uncomfortable things that we need to explore in our lives. They actually don't care that you're uncomfortable. They actually could give a shit about your feelings. What they care about is that you're actually going to become better.
And if that is the path of least resistance, they might even just push you down, to be honest.
Right. And you can avoid it, and then you'll get a cosmic 2x4 to the head. I mean, yeah. It's what is not integrated will be repeated, you know, and that's a lesson of life. It's like, we wonder why we do the same things, why we choose the same people. It's because we haven't excavated and stepped into the gold. We haven't. And, you know, what do they call it? Let go or be dragged. Like, it's a choice. It's not an easy choice, because even stepping into your unfamiliar potential is terrifying. You might turn out to be nothing, but then you could turn out to be everything.
I was, I do this in the back of my head, and I've never said this to anyone before, but coming onto the podcast, I have this like theme in the back of my head. And for yourself, it was Mark Unfuck Your Patterns Groves.
Well, I like to be welcomed into this mystery thought process you have.
But I can tell I'm way too comfortable with you as it is to be even able to share that with you. And I think that
let's unfuck some patterns.
Yeah. Because I think in there, like, there's this whole, yeah, we're starting to venture into, yeah, when we, like you said, you know, if we don't address things, and I think there's a worthy conversation to be had around how, what, like, and I'm sure it's different situation to situation, emotion to emotion, moment to moment, in terms of how we address what's coming up. And however, we do replay our patterns, like you said, if we don't integrate them. Still laughing at the fact that I told you what I told you.
Well, you unfucked a pattern by sharing it.
Case in point. Yeah. How do we do the work to have a look in general, like, in, you know, maybe what does it look like in your world to look at the what doesn't want to be looked at, and then potentially how that starts to disrupt some of these patterns that we carry in. Yeah,
you know, there's no transformation that doesn't begin without being able to tell the truth. So, you know, I think one of the first steps in really every course I have and every invitation I have to people, usually they come to my work kind of in this place, which is that you have to be able to be honest with yourself about who you are, what you choose, who you're being, what your challenges are. You know, like, it's like any form of addiction. You know, it starts with the acceptance that the addiction exists. You know, and I think it's the same with any behavior. Like, you can't want to change how you show up to a relationship if you can't accept that you get defensive. I had to accept that I manipulated people in dialogue because I was afraid of being seen. I was afraid of being the one who actually was the issue or had the issue, and that was the issue, because I didn't have the ability for my worth to be decoupled from the feedback I was getting about how I showed up to life. And so really, by being able to say, this is a behavior I have, it's not who I am, most people don't realize that like, habits are not who you are. So you can change your habits, because at the core is what we're talking about, this return to the essence of you. But these patterns that you have that protect from this idea that you might be discovered, you might be discovered as being vulnerable, you might be discovered as being sneaky, you know, and even all that part of ourselves of, like, knowing that we all have shadow, we all have manipulation, we all have sneaky ways that we try to not get hurt again. So I think the beginning part is accepting who you actually are, and then really starting to hang out with community that does the same, because you need people who can unconditionally love you, which doesn't mean tolerate your bullshit.
Sorry.
That's true. You know, it's like, a lot of the times what I'll see misinterpreted in an expression of finding compassion for a perspective someone has, let's say, or an experience they have, is there's this idea that you're supposed to tolerate it. But, you know, I can have compassion for why someone is emotionally abusive, but that doesn't mean I'm going to tolerate their emotional abuse. You know, me knowing that, well, they had a difficult childhood, their dad was a narcissist. Great. That's all context. And it can allow me to see the humanness in them. But the adult in me says, not here. Love doesn't do that. We don't do that. I love you, but I choose to not be in relationship with you when you are that way. So unconditional love is not unconditional tolerance. And I think when we can, usually we end up, let's say, making a giant choice like leaving a relationship or leaving a job. And we find the people who have never left a relationship and never left a job will be most critical because we've now reflected to them a possibility that they've not chosen.
So now, back to what you were describing before about your own engagement. Yeah, sorry.
Exactly. And then that will actually cause a lot of us to go back to the old pattern, to stay in the job, to get rid of the dream, to go back to the person, right? And so this is this chance that we usually end up being rejected from sort of the frameworks that kept us in the box. And so our parents might be reactive to the choice we make, but we've always pleased our parents. So now we have to actually sit with the discomfort of not pleasing them. We have always pleased society. We always pleased our community. And now we have to sit with the fact that we actually have to displease them to please ourselves. And so there's this recalibration that goes on where, and it's a reorientation, which is saying, instead of you constantly reacting to the world is now learning to orient around you a little bit. And that shuffle is usually what makes people stop because it's too uncomfortable to be the center of your universe, which does not mean to be self-centered, which is very different. It just means that you're a self and you exist and you get to be in relationship with other adults who can stay in their own lane. And your dreams and you stepping into your power doesn't make people less powerful. It actually makes them more powerful. But if the game is power, and it's this idea that you have more power than me and power is a finite thing, then we start to hold on tighter. So that was a long answer to your question. So I apologize. I hope that...
You do not get to apologize in this podcast. No. Hey, your Inspired Tribe. I want to take a quick sec. I wanted to share something today with you that is really dear to my heart. And it's actually what keeps the entire ecosystem around the Inspired Evolution thriving, my one-on-one coaching. So it's basically coaching that helps you live a spiritually aligned life. I coach people from all different types of walks of life. These people are leaders and they're looking to have an incredible spiritual impact in the lives that they're leading for themselves and then also lead in alignment to their values. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Here's a few people that have also transformed through my coaching and here's what they have to say.
Amrit is a fantastic coach.
In a few sessions, he got to a depth that I'd only experienced before working with certain medicines.
He's gone through a lot of the struggles that you're probably facing.
Then my corporate banking job wasn't really doing it.
You feel like you're not making progress towards your goals.
And Amrit's been a really strong, supportive figure in my journey.
I'm more in control of myself.
I'm kinder to myself.
I actually have that vision and a purpose.
I do feel like I'm a better version of myself already.
Amazing energy.
He was easy to talk to, which made me easy to trust him.
Working with Amrit at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and really I was bouncing out of bed.
Whenever I get off the calls with Amrit, best money we've ever spent.
I would not recommend him because I don't want everyone to know about him and then I won't be able to book him. If he gets too busy, I won't get my turn.
I would say absolutely.
There's no way you can work with Amrit for a period of time without being transformed.
So if you're considering him as a coach, do not hesitate because you won't be disappointed.
As you guys can see, there's a lot of people all over the world from all these different corners experiencing incredible transformations. I don't think, if I can say humbly myself, that there is anything quite like this somewhere else online. Most people that, you know, have channels that, you know, grow and grow and grow don't really focus on one-to-one offerings. I have just found that it is the most profound space where you can bring yourself in a private container and really just share what's going on for yourself. And if you want to book in for that call with me, touch base, it's www.amrit.coach/life. That's www.amrit.coach/life. There is a link in the show notes below to book in that call. And yeah, if you want to take your journey further, if you want to dive in deeper and you really want to live a spiritually aligned life, if it's for you, please do check it out. And without too much further ado, once again, for your spirit, for yourself, today's podcast. And part of me surprised we made it this far in the conversation without touching this cornerstone, let's call it that. There's a whole, because what we're currently sort of discussing a little bit around is the tribe and the tribe mentality versus our individual truth. And I guess absolutely there's, you know, the egalitarian utopia where our individual truth is what is most highly celebrated within the tribe, you know, and that's what I love what you gave in your response is like, learn your truth, accept it, and then find community around it, right? Which is an incredible recipe. But I guess there begs that question around, even us just touching base to get your sentiment around, because when I come into your work, I really start to understand, okay, we have tribes and the patterns of the tribe sort of inform the patterns that we step out into. But there is almost like this innate,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Divine truth that we're also carrying. And there is this reconciliation that needs to happen in some ways, to some degree. I'm not even sure if reconciliation is the right word. And maybe it is recalibration as well. But I found that was, for me, really coming to your work was, it was really important to understand the tribe versus the individual and trying to realize that there shouldn't, like, the versus is a really weird thing to claim it as. Sorry, and I'll let you unpack that further for us. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how it first is. You know, till about the age of eight, you're learning, especially unconsciously, implicitly and explicitly, what it means to be part of a family, what it means to be part of a culture, a community. And there's a lot of positive things to that. Like, you know, you play with kids of different ages and you learn not to talk back to older kids. You learn to, you know, maybe obey the rules of the game that you're playing. Let's say you're playing baseball or something. So there's this really interconnectedness that teaches you how to be part of groups. The challenge is that if you're not in communities with other people who celebrate individuation, celebrate possibility, but also carry the weights of your childhood with you. You know, mature adults won't let the experience you have, let's say you get abused as a kid, a mature community would make sure that that abuse doesn't become something that you center around yourself. Children, and I use this word loosely, but children have a very narcissistic view of the world. And that is that if an adult doesn't show up for them and they think, well, they have two choices, my dad or my mom are bad people, or they can't show up, they're not healthy. That thought is too confronting for a child. The second thought is there's something wrong with me that they can't show up. And that's usually what a kid chooses unless there's a community around them to help them actually see it that way. Now, what we're talking about when Gabor Mate talks about this, that we have two needs. We have the need for self-expression and we have the need for belonging. But when self-expression threatens belonging, belonging wins.
Yeah.
Till you realize as an adult when you need to make a choice that you just somehow feel like you can't make, or you have a dream that wants to come alive, and all of a sudden you notice that your view or your value or your perspective is actually bumping up against the agreed norms of your community. Right. Yeah. So now I have to choose, can I be a self and threaten the belonging? And sometimes we'll lose that, right? Like, you see that all the time. People fully step into what they desire. They quit drinking and they surround themselves with people who drink. All of a sudden, they can't be in that community anymore. And also what we'll discover is that what are communities that celebrate me fully stepping into myself and belonging? Because if you choosing you threatens our connection, then that means our connection is predicated on the idea that you shouldn't be you. And this is codependency, right? This is how most relationships are actually constructed. It's unconscious. It's not malicious. It's like, if you need me, then you can't leave. If I need you, then I can't leave. And there's a beautiful interdependence that can be created, which is we're going to talk about the ways we need each other, but none of them are prisons. You know, none of them are prisons. Because the moment, you know, there's a saying from Harriet Lerner. She's a brilliant relationship teacher, psychologist. She says, if you're not free to come and go from a relationship, which she's not saying like polyamory in and out the door. She's saying, if you literally don't have the resources and the capability and the safety, then you won't feel free to be yourself in the relationship. My wife and I have a recognition that realistically, you know this about your wife, I know this about mine. She could decide in any day that she wants to leave. Like, that's just the truth. We made vows to each other, but the vows are not based on, I'll never leave you. The vows are based on, I choose you. And I recognize that. Yes. And so if she can choose to leave, that means she can choose to stay, which means if I can orient to the honor and the sacred choice that she's making to be with me, of all the people she could choose, she chooses me. Wow. Now I'm going to work hard to keep her. Right? Yeah. And touch wood. But it's like, I know that if it was in her highest regard that she needed to go somewhere and do something without me, my relationship to her honors that in her. I will love her no matter what she chooses. She knows that. And I know that. It would be the hardest thing in the world. I already know that. But our love wouldn't go anywhere, which is a strange mindfuck for a lot of people.
It really is. And I've actually lived it. Touch wood.
We were too.
About 6 years into our relationship, and my wife took a 10-month sabbatical, basically a year-long sabbatical, where she went away to go find herself. I remember going into work and people going, "So your wife's on a beach in Brazil, and you're here at work, and she could be picking up any guy doing anything." And I'm like, "Yeah, pretty much." And they're like, "She's not like that at all." Obviously, you know, we've got that. As you describe, like, yeah, that trust and freedom to allow. But also, like, it's, and I'd love to sort of riff on you with this, because at the time it is a total mindfuck, but I thought the mindfuckiest bit was me bumping up against society's expectations, because they're like, "How did you let your wife go?" And I was like, let her go. Like, come on, like, you know, this is what the, you know, we're equals in this. But the mindfucky bit for me, just to sort of throw this into the conversation, touch wood, was, it was somewhat selfish on my behalf, because I was like, if you're not feeling whole and you're my partner and you know that you need to, this is what's like life is calling you to do, is take 10 months, go travel, explore the world, find yourself again to fill your cup up. Like, from a selfish perspective, I kind of want a whole partner. Like, go on, get out of here. Right. Go do your thing.
Well,
right?
You know, it's in service of the relationship.
Touch wood, but it was like, I was the only, not that I was the only, but like for me, I was the only one that was, it felt like at the time we talk about belonging versus self-expression. That's what my self-expression was. It was like, this is what my truth is like, I want her to go find herself. Like, that's what I want for her. But all the belonging and all the tribe was like, how the fuck, what the fuck? Like, you like, what, where is she? What is she? And I was
you're breaking agreements about how we do relationships.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because my wife and I broke up for 9 months and we were not married at the time, but we broke up and, you know, it was in service of love. And that's the thing is like, would we come back together? We didn't plan on it. I didn't. But you know what's really interesting is like, if someone doing what your wife did is act, if it's in service of them, it's in service of you. If it's in service of them, it's in service of the relationship. Even if the relationship doesn't continue, it's in service of the relationship.
Yeah.
But that's unconditional love. And that's removing what people might think about us breaking up. Because what you put second was what people thought about your relationship. Oh, who are you? You let her go. I imagine your wife wouldn't like the term let her go. But if you look at inherited relationship patterns, that's the kind of language we have. And oftentimes we want to be able to approve or disapprove of someone's path because we're afraid it's going to pull them away from us. Which actually what's really interesting is as I mature, I recognize this. 20-year-old me never would have been able to have this conversation. Puka shell necklaces, frosted tips, not a chance. Because I was terrified of being left. But now I recognize that, oh my God, like whatever brings one person more alive in a relationship, it brings the relationship more alive. And then, you know, if someone can choose to go on that adventure and fill their cup and then choose to come back, they know your love's not conditional. And that's beautiful. So applause to you.
Not applause. Touchwood, like I said, it felt selfish to me. I needed the applause. The interesting piece that we're at is, well, there's so many interesting pieces. The key thing in there for me that's being begged to elicit upon is self-expression versus belonging. Do you think there's a shift currently underway? Like, is there space for hope for us that, you know, more and more people are being accepted for who their innate truths are, or are the patterns just rife and they're everywhere and it's on us to do the work to find our truth and then recalibrate and then find our community? And that's just the work. Maybe it just is. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
Man, that's such a good question. Cause I think you look at, let's say, what people would recognize American culture or maybe even UK culture a bit too, versus Canada, more collectivist mind, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. Again, I'm generalizing. Different people's experience might be different, but I'd say that overtly American culture represents overt independence, which actually independence is healthy. And then there's overt collectivism, which is like, know me at the cost of the nothing. I can never take up space at the cost of the community. Both of those actually are really important because if you look at what determines healthy relating, the question we're always, I'd say, struggling with is, can I hold on to me and be in a relationship? Most people erase themselves in service of connection of a relationship. So you hear the language from, like, I'm going to date myself, but average age of the audience is 45. I'm 45. So let's do this. Jerry Maguire, right? You complete me. This like famous line. Everyone thought it was so romantic, but it gives this idea that it is through your soulmate, your twin flame, this like piece of your soul that you find in another person. That language equates to that you're not complete without this missing piece. And I think why language matters so much is that articulation is still that there's a gap that needs to be filled. And I'm saying if you step fully into yourself and into a relationship with someone else who is a self, you create a separate entity. Now, some people, as I said, they forego themselves to be in a relationship. Other people forego a relationship for themselves. They're an island. They can't access intimacy, connection. They run from deep, deep, meaningful bonds. That's protective too. So I think collectively what you're saying is representative of the thing. It's the meta version of what I'm saying people do in relationship. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of perspectives on this, but mine is that during the last 3 years, a lot of collectivism was actually used in the language to get people to comply with public health policy. Again, this isn't a what's right, what's wrong, what you choose to put in your body. None of that. That's a whole other podcast. But for me, what I found not okay in that was that the psychological, so governments and public health use things called nudge tactics. Nudge tactics are about changing collective behavior. They're not right or wrong, but they can be used in unethical ways. So what I saw was that we really used belonging as a mechanism to get more compliance. And so you use like have each other's back. We're in this together. Again, not judging the language, but the language itself created this overt collectivism. Yeah. And so if you take that to the political front too, you have, and again, I'm generalizing, you have left and right, which I would say this now is this perception that you can either be conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican. And so it gives this illusion that there's only these two ways. And actually, if you look, the choices about what you did from a public health perspective also decide if you're left or right. So you have these ideological frameworks, which let's call them just archetypes. And if I see one thing you do, I just put you in the rest of the things, and then I don't have to listen to you, or I might feel really connected to you. So that tribalism, I think, although there is more acceptance maybe within small communities of diverse views of what you choose to do with your life, that actually seems to have been amplified as even more separated now. Even I feel like we were really, which, you know, the argument from a spiritual perspective is, well, all of that was buried anyways and in the shadow and is just being brought out to be healed. And I think that's true. Like, division is way more amplified than it's ever been. And I would argue that's due to social media as well. Algorithms, the like button, you know, how it just gives you more of what you already want to see, or it enrages you. So it gives you these illusions of ideological bubbles. Anyways, my point being that 0.1% of the people in the world actually live in these ideological extremes. But because we don't generally see long-form, nuanced conversation about, you know, let's be honest, most people have some beliefs that live in between all of these things. That's the fluidity of being a human. And I think as we embody or model dialogue more, like long-form conversations like this, especially with people we disagree with. Like, I spend a lot of time in the US, and I noticed this through witnessing like Australian media, but also in Canada. We don't tend to have a tolerance to sit down with someone who just has a different political belief. And, you know, I know people who can't stand because someone voted for Trump, and people who can't stand because someone voted for Biden, or, you know, insert political person in different country. And I'm like, man, we used to sit down and break bread with people and just at least ask them questions. And so, no, I don't think we're better than we were. I do think there's more tolerance for leaving mainstream perspectives, like leaving a marriage, you know, choosing to be an entrepreneur. Those types of things have changed. But I would say ideologically, we seem, I don't know, more divided than we've ever been. What do you think?
The way you've described it is hard to refute, to be honest. I do feel it's a question that, especially being a podcaster and a coach, I come up with a lot, because I'm aware that I see a particular lens of society. Like, I see people that are spiritually oriented, you know, and I'm just conscious of the good vibe tribe that I'm a part of, you know, and we're all supporting each other to grow, to nurture, to learn, like create the love, I'm sure, you know, is all about integrating your shadow, but then also bringing it to the light. So there's a lot of light in there as well, touch wood. And so I generally ask the question from that place, because it's an awareness of trying to, just not suffocate in my own little echo chamber, if that makes sense. Just bring a bit more of an awareness to what, you know, what do you think is going on at large. And I think it's really interesting, even as you were describing, you know, the two polarized lens, like even just if we just take left and right for a sec, like even as I'm sitting here, like in me, there's certain things that I'm right about and there's certain things that I'm left about, you know, and I it's just so interesting to just feel like on a bit, you know, you don't support a vaccination, so you're left. And it's like, well, no, you know, like,
right.
Big part of me, I grew up in an Indian household on Bollywood. I didn't even have a Disney, bro. Like, I'm like, I could be very traditional and right, bro, if you really want to get down into it, like, you know. So I do think there's a real polarization. And I think it's really interesting the way you introduced, I love the way you introduced it. Spiritually, there is a lot of shadow being popping up. There's a lot of shadow effervescence, let's call it that, to sort of at this time to really integrate it back. And that maybe this is a good time for us to be able to do the work, but hashtag need to do the work sort of thing. Because I do see, just blisterings in society. And I think even some parts of us are sort of challenged by I find myself being surrounded by the echo chamber that I do have going, oh, that's still happening. Like a war will pop up and you're like, oh, really? Yeah, right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like that's still out there. That's really interesting, you know, and it seems further removed from my sense of reality. And then it's like, oh, I've popped into a bubble somewhere. You know, and I think, mm-hmm. like you alluded to, I think it's important for us to sort of, well, at least be aware of the boundaries of our bubble to some degree, just so that we're able to integrate more of the human experience. Now, this gets really, I don't know how to articulate what I'm trying to say without going this far in, but I often meditate on the frequency of Krishna, and now just going there. And Krishna as an individual is, his whole thing is connection. And I bring him up because I know connection's a big part of your work and it's my highest value. And I was, you know, I'm sure we were going to get to connection at some point. Potentially not Krishna, but here we are.
And go into it, yeah.
Krishna had this really interesting life journey when you follow his story through, Indians believe it's history, but anyway, through the mythology, let's call it that. And as he's going through, he travels on foot, like very far distances, to just be present at battles, to be present with family, like in, you know, palace disputes and all this sort of stuff. And as you start to uncode it, one of the frequencies you start to realize is that he was present in a lot of places. And there was a lot of connection to experiences to enrich the human experience, and the importance of connection to really learn and distill from, you know, there's an opportunity that we have being alive to really connect to one another, connect to experiences, to connect to what life really has to offer us in its many different facets. I can feel the soapbox that I'm on growing taller as I'm speaking.
It's great.
But there's that element of, you know, allowing the edges of the bubble to somewhat soften and just sort of approach the other to sort of learn about the human experience, because we are here to learn from one another. And yeah, I guess that sort of segues me back as a monkey rope back into your work from, yeah, just, oh, we were always there, but connection. In a divided and a more polarized world, like it must be harder to champion connection. Do you find the challenges being a champion for connection?
Well, I think at the core of really true intimate connection is curiosity. And I would argue that a lot of ideological or a lot of ideologies or narratives are actually not allowed to be questioned, you know, which is much like, depending where you live, because this isn't true for everybody, you weren't allowed to question marriage. You weren't allowed to question your faith. You weren't allowed to question anything. And that was then seen as just an aspect of faith. You know, you weren't allowed to question what job you're supposed to get. You weren't allowed to question a lot of things. And that keeps getting challenged as we sort of, I would guess, mature on some level. But, you know, my experience is that there's a lot of things that if you question, you get canceled. You know, I think I was thinking about this the other day, that we've really, we've conflated agreeableness with morality. And that idea that you're of higher moral virtue if you agree with everything. And I think, you know, this is such a delicate conversation. I always think of like YouTube algorithms and Instagram algorithms and let's actually just use that as explicit evidence that only certain things are allowed to be said and only certain perspectives are really going to get more algorithmic reach. Did we ever think that we'd live in a time that's actually evidence that it exists, that censorship exists, that narrative shaping exists. Again, I don't think of that from like a conspirituality perspective. I actually just, it's just factual. It just is. Mm. So then we have to come to the realization that, wait, if you look at all of human history, there's always been narrative shaping. It's much more easily accessible and we have computers that get to just automatically do it for us. But I think what's always existed is lots of suffering in the world and lots of challenges in the world. And what it always comes back to is, am I able to be captured by ideologies? Am I in judgment? Am I in shaming? Am I curious? And, you know, the more our beliefs are tied to our own identities, like I don't label myself as left or right or any of that because then I don't have flexibility. You know, just like I don't label myself as pro or anti anything. I just want to be part of the conversation. And it is through dialogue in intimate relationship that more intimacy is created. It's not that great couples don't fight. It's that they just fight differently. They fight fair. They don't not have conflict. It's just the way they navigate conflict is that they see each other as the potential for more wisdom. Jonathan Haidt has this great quote in his book, Coddling of the American Mind, or actually, I think it was just in one of his interviews that he did, where he said that when two people come to a dialogue, what is produced from that is a third perspective, and it is seemingly wiser than the first two. And I always think of that, like without two people disagreeing, you actually don't get the process, the alchemical process of the third thing that only comes through diverse thought. There is not a single ecosystem and relational system and human system that cannot eventually be made more prosperous and more sacred when it is exposed to diversity. And so for me, it's really like, how do we live the questions? How do we live the curiosities? How do we, like, you know, like when I hear that someone votes for someone, there's the human part of me that's like, oh my God, how did they vote for them? But then there's the actual part of me that knows that I could be totally wrong that says, tell me about it. Like, what appeals to you about that person? What appeals to you about that movement? What appeals to you? Why do you feel it's going to save us? What aspect are you afraid of? You know, I look at subjects like what's going on in, I'm not even sure I could use the word because it'll probably cause but in the east of the world. And it's like, to me, there's so much opportunity to understand the suffering that exists on both sides, that you're not anti one thing if you're one side, you're pro-human. And man, I saw this funny meme, but it's not funny, but it was funny. And it was saying that, like, maybe we should just not let the craziest people run the world for a little bit. Like, and I'm like, wow, yeah. Like, imagine what was possible if we all sat down, like, think about how many people die for other people's egoic purpose or for the more exploitation of the planet.
Yeah. It's funny at the surface level, like you said. And then when you start to unpack that, I remember seeing a similar meme, which, yeah, sort of drives the point home in a more sinister way, which is, you know, we basically have young men going to fight the ego battle between two old guys. And the young men are collecting all this trauma, potentially dying, coming back.
And they become the old guys who run the wars too.
Yeah.
You know, the cycle continues. Although I do think, you know, it's like, you know, I often think in the conversation about, let's say, toxic masculinity, et cetera, is one, I'm always like, well, first off, masculinity itself is not toxic. Unintegrated trauma is toxic. And if we're going to explore what toxic masculinity is, then let's explore what toxic human, like what, how humans express when they're toxic. What does that look like for women too? Right? Because this is the type of triggering dialogue that actually creates more understanding. Because where the term toxic masculinity comes from is from the desire. There are traits and people feel harmed by men. Okay, that's true. Okay, let's go deeper into that. Let's understand that. And what I think is interesting is in the exploration of all this is that we have healing to do. We have so much healing to do, and we have to be able to hear things. But I think of like biology. I think of, I forget what spider it is. Maybe it's a praying mantis actually, but it like once it has sex, it then bites the head off the male. And yeah, so, and I'm obviously not a freaking biologist, but what I think is interesting about that example is that if all of a sudden that bug woke up to what it just did and had empathy and compassion, it would be like, holy crap, I just ate my lover's head. Like, I just killed him. And I think what there's a point where biological species becomes more spiritual and integrated, develops more empathy, and then has to then look at its history and explore what it's done. Actually, not totally dissimilar to my own shame exorcism as a writer and as a teacher. But it's like we are waking up to what we have been doing for survival as an instinctual biological being. And I don't know where the spiritual, more empathic, awakened higher consciousness version of us kept coming online. I know the argument is that it was after we all did mushrooms. But it's like, can we just be with that there are things we need to resolve that are inherited ways of being, but that we can actually live in a more conscious way today? Does that make sense?
It totally does. It totally does. And there's a super, like, this is a big conversation in there. I'm just going to pick at this little grain of sand on the beach, which is even just, and I think it's really practical because you mentioned it even before, like, not in this conversation, but me following your work, we don't really get to see what resolution even looks like when people are carrying it. I was even, because I've got a 2.5-year-old and I've got a 2-week-old.
Oh, you have a 2-week-old?
Yeah, bro. Yeah, it's totally
dude,
happening.
Congratulations. I have a 10-month-old and I'm like, man, yeah, the first 3 months I was like talking to this guy who's like, oh, we're about to have our third kid. And I'm like, do you forget what it's like
in you the do first biologically, bit? You actually yeah. do.
He was like, yeah, actually you do forget. Yeah, sorry. So go on. Congrats.
Yeah, and the point was that, like, yeah, I notice, like, my wife and I, like, have healthy dispute, right? Like, it's like, oh, I believe this and I believe that. We have different value sets. My highest value is connection. Hers is integrity. And sometimes they butt up against each other, which is totally normal. You know, it's a beautiful thing in many ways, like you were saying about diversity. But then there will be that at the end of the night, we're going to bed and it's like, oh, we had that butt up today, but I still love you, yeah? And she's like, yeah, I love you too. Touch wood. Resolved, right? Like, resolved. Touch wood. But he wasn't there to see that. But he was there for the bit where we butted up against each other. And so, you know, and that was really, and your work really left me with that is like, as kids, we oftentimes see the clash because it's spur of the moment, the emotions are charged and people are negligent of who's around, you know, it's just like the emotions sort of spur it, pour out of you. But then you don't see when it's like calms down. It's like, actually, no, there's something deep. And you perpetuate that generation upon generation a little bit without actually people seeing the reconciliation. They potentially don't learn how to reconcile. They potentially don't learn how to heal within themselves. They, you know, and it's like, oh, it's actually really important to recognize that we also need to do that bit publicly as well. And potentially even as a father, as a male, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, your mum was right. You know, and it goes against patriarchal thinking.
Right,
like,
right.
And to be honest, she's always right.
This time.
Let's just be real about it. She's always right. Yeah.
I feel that way actually very often about my wife too. You know?
Yeah.
But that's the reverence to the feminine too, is like there was a comfort that we have when we can see women as less than or not as brilliant, not as bright, not as, and then you realize that they oscillate around the moon. When they get together, they coordinate. Like, I think about how my wife and son communicate to change unconsciously, to change what is in the milk for what he needs. Like, I'm sitting here like, do you want a popsicle?
Can I get you a muesli bar?
Yeah, and she is actually calibrating her milk without even saying anything. So there's the orientation, no matter your gender combination, the orientation to your partner as being a wise, brilliant being who can see you in a way you can't see you in is actually an invitation to your greatest evolution. If you start to see a relationship as a container for your liberation of where you get triggered, where you get stuck, where you need to heal, then you actually orient to the relationship from a place of being a gift. Most of us don't do that because the way we first pursue partnership is we're drawn to people who wound us in a way that's familiar, that's similar to our parents. We don't do that on purpose because that would be crazy. But we find each other that way because there's still something that needs to be resolved. And you know what you're saying is such a good reminder. I've been thinking about this just yesterday. I started thinking about that. If you look at platforms like Instagram, TikTok, YouTube Shorts, they're short form content. They're usually less than 90 seconds. So what we are constantly being exposed to, and algorithmically, in order to make a 90 second or 1 minute video do well, you would probably start with something that's triggering. Or something that's inflammatory, and that not meaning insulting, but just something that gets you going, charged. So what's the result? Okay, well, I can only in 60 seconds or 90 seconds convey so much about a perspective. Algorithmically, you're going to be exposed to things that either really confirm what you see or really don't. That's because it keeps you on there. And you know, I forget who said this, but I loved it. He said that they're colonizing every second of your life. They took all the land and now they want all your attention because your attention is monetizable. Every moment of your day is monetizable. So if you actually see that you're a social project and you're actually monetizable, then you should get mad. But the other thing is because your attention is being taken from you without your consent, and there are social engineers whose literal job is to figure out how to do that to you. And they are profit-driven companies. And their whole point is to make more money. And that's not a moral thing, although it's immoral, but you know, that's, it just is. But I say all that because if you watch 60 to 90 second videos, you're never exposed to nuance, and you never watch adults have long form conversations like this, where we're talking through all the different aspects of something. So, you know, if you think how many billion users there are on Instagram, they're not watching long form stuff. They don't even have the attention span generally to listen to a long form podcast. They hate Joe Rogan a lot of the time because he has long, because they think he's right wing, even though I would argue he's actually fairly liberal. Yeah, I think he's said he's always voted left. So again, these are these ways that we're just not exposed to the modeling of nuance. And platforms don't actually even algorithmically share much nuance. I think YouTube is an exception because, you know, here we are having this long conversation that a certain percentage of people will make it through. But it's really interesting how what you said about watching couples is actually also what we need to do just between people who don't agree. And a lot of the dialogue about the most inflammatory subjects, you know, which I think are pretty obvious, things like what the public health stuff that's happened, things like what's going on in the wars, things like gender, things like climate. Can you tell me where you've watched on a mainstream media two people who disagree have a dialogue about that? I've not seen a single. I've seen one perspective shared en masse for every single one of those ideologies. And so what that does is create the idea or illusion of consensus. But it's easy to have consensus when you don't share the voices of anyone who doesn't agree.
That rebukes it.
Yeah. Like imagine if all you ever saw your parents do was your dad talk. And he's the one who was always right. And your mother was quiet. What would you learn? Well, the woman would learn to never speak up. And the man would learn that he's never to be criticized. And he'd be fragile about being criticized. And she would be terrified of speaking up. and using her voice. That's a pretty accurate model of not just a lot of relationships and people as they grow up, but also our society.
State of the world. Mm-hmm. I want to extrapolate your microanalysis of how we're going with social media a little bit, because I've noticed there is this social engineering does sort of speed up our relationship with attention. You can watch things on 1.5 times the speed. There's a frequency of like, okay, I'm consuming something in 30 seconds and everything
goes
a little bit faster. I can flick to the next thing and here I go. And it speeds up. Everything speeds up a little bit. And I notice even, and this is going to sound like me being the total hippie that I am, but I'll sit down at a park bench to meditate. And before I do, I'll just be sitting there and I'll just take a moment to land. And there's been times where I just haven't taken that moment to land, similar to how we started this podcast. And I'll just go into my meditation and later on find like, oh, I sat really close to an ant hill or something, you know. But if I take that moment to land and I just look at the earth, spend some time, and it's like, oh, we do, check that out. There's something going on in the grass over there. But that attention to detail, that slowing down to the finer, more refined things, which is actually some of the beauty in life, I've had to learn as a metaphor, requires active pacing. Like it requires me to slow down, to appreciate. And what I'm hoping to draw a jump to or parallels to near is that's ever present in relationships as well. I've noticed for myself recently as a really important piece, because we are, you know, there's that meme where two people are both like lying in the same bed but scrolled over on the side of their phones at night sleeping, you know, like attached to their phones. And there's that, you know, that's maybe one extreme, but also just taking a moment to put the phone down and just have a conversation with your partner and just feel into the moment, be present with your family. The mind and the ego, I find, loves this sort of speeding upness. But there's a real beauty that is available to us, that's only really available to us, is actually what I'm trying to say, when we do slow down, pace ourselves, and take a moment, like you said, like you're alluding to, have the dialogue, appreciate different perspectives. Just, you know, it requires a slowing down and to actually appreciate the nuance and the differences is just what I wanted to pepper in there.
Yeah, I mean, think about that I appreciate the idea of landing. Because, man, I love consuming books at 1.5 times speed. So I saw a lot of myself in that. But it's amazing how much you then want the world at 1.5 times speed. And if you want the world at 1.5 times speed, that means 80 years is 60. You know, and I know when I just went to Peru. And when I was in Peru, there was no technology available. Like you couldn't text or anything. You could listen to audiobooks or something. But what I noticed is at night we would all gather in the main, you know, hall with the hammocks, and we'd all sit around and talk and connect. And it reminded me so much of the world prior to smartphones, like the world I grew up in. And I thought, man, we're going to be the last generation that actually knows by choice, right? Sorry, not by choice. You would have to by choice live that life now. But that was one of the richest experiences of being in Peru, was that I was reminded of how slow time moves when you're present, how it is in these like spaces between words and the spaces between beats, and just how powerful it is to, because technology moves at an incredible speed, not just developmentally, but quick video, quick thought, quick algorithm, quick, right? And man, your whole life can be spent doom scrolling. And we miss so much of the world. You know, I think about, like, I watched this psychologist give this talk once where he was saying that the way that children learn empathy is actually through, one, communicating with their parents and being attuned to. And so if a parent is on a phone a lot, they're not attuning to the child, and the child sees that the phone or technology is more important than the child. But actually, when kids have their own technology, which is not really recommended below the age of 5, but I would argue it's probably older than that, is that they're looking down at technology and not looking at humans interacting. And actually, the way that we learn empathy is by watching adults, like you were saying, your wife and you having a conversation, our kids learn that. And so that's how they learn how to model emotion and feedback and all that kind of stuff. And so when we aren't capable of empathy, we are narcissistic. And so you think of, like, we live in a currently young people generally, and I'm sound like an old guy now, but what occurs is that we live in a very individualistic framework in that I want you to know who I am. You have to call me what I want you to call me. I need you to notice how special I am. I need to have a good social following. I need lots of likes. I want to become an influencer. Again, there's no judgment on any of these things. What I'm pointing out is that your specialness will never be validated by people outside you. Your need to get people to validate and see you as unique, the pursuit of it actually causes the wounding. It just perpetuates the wounding. So when I think of, like, true connection, to be truly seen, you have to be willing to be truly seen, which at the basis of needing to cling to anything is fear. And I say all of that as, like, my own identity was tied to teaching relationship. My own identity, even though I'm conscious of these things, I've been captured by these things.
The patterns. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, wait, I make my money by teaching this stuff. What happens if the algorithm doesn't like me anymore? You know, which it didn't. So insert the lesson. You're not any of those things. You're not your sort of, you know, but we need to learn how to cultivate connection and empathy and model it. And that starts with us, like, saying, man, my phone's getting in the way.
Mm.
And now, you know, they have, I don't know if you've seen the Light Phone. The Light Phone is a phone that only texts, has music,
has
podcasts.
Yes. The old school flip phones are coming out and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's just like a monochromatic little phone. And I talked to the founders, and they used to work, I forget, at like Facebook or Google, but they were saying that the whole design is of the phone is so that you cannot doom scroll. There's no endless, you can't go to play your music and then end up running down an endless, because they want you to be present to the world. And I'm like, wow, isn't that crazy that we have to create technology that doesn't allow us to, again, the spider or whatever biting the head off the partner, we are still biological beings. We are still nervous systems. We're still dopamine driven.
Mm.
And we have to be mindful of that, that we are. And the thing that makes people captured by ideologies and cell phones is the belief that they can't be.
Mm.
And so everyone can be, we just have to accept that. And so if you can accept that you can be, then you could say, am I?
And then start to make the shift from there.
Ideally.
Mm. Mark, I feel like we've just scratched the surface. Yet we're so deep down the rabbit hole, and I knew this was going to be the case.
We need a part two.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't want to force you into a public acknowledgement. You might have hated this conversation with me and be like, can I get you back on the podcast?
I'd love to come back on. I'd love to come back on.
And I was also smirking to myself, because even where we left the conversation was very Mark, unfuck your patterns, gross.
It's perfect.
Touch wood. Pardon me for that. And, you know, but also just taking a moment as we do wrap things up here to just acknowledge you. Brother, because I definitely want to thank you for today's conversation and your time and your presence here, which, you know, invariably I will do, but also it's, you know, we get to stand on the conversation, the shoulders in this conversation of all the, we discussed excavating deeply in this conversation today and just the excavation that you've afforded yourself. And, you know, we've been able to really revel in some really gooey, deep crevice topics, which are really important to shine some light in. And so it'd be remiss of me just not to, yes, thank you for today's conversation, but also acknowledge you for who you are and what you're doing in the world, bro. It really means a lot to me, and I'm really inspired to be able to share this conversation with the world. And yeah, there's just a lot of love for what you do and how you do it. And I would love to continue this conversation again, but don't be greedy.
I love it. I'd be honored. And I am honored. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for your kind words. Thank you to you, the audience, for trusting me with your time, something you can't get back, but you can live at one time speed. And I'm really just so grateful, honestly. Thank you for what you do and for stepping in your passion and being so, and embodying the humility we talked about.
Hey, your Inspired Tribe. I want to take a quick sec. I wanted to share something today with you that is really dear to my heart. And it's actually what keeps the entire ecosystem around the Inspired Evolution thriving, my one-on-one coaching. So it's basically coaching that helps you live a spiritually aligned life. I coach people from all different types of walks of life. These people are leaders and they're looking to have an incredible spiritual impact in the lives that they're leading for themselves, and then also lead in alignment to their values. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Here's a few people that have also transformed through my coaching, and here's what they have to say.
Amrit is a fantastic coach.
In a few sessions, he got to a depth that I'd only experienced before working with certain medicines.
He's gone through a lot of the struggles that you're probably facing.
Then my corporate banking job wasn't really doing it.
You feel like you're not making progress towards your goals.
And Amrit's been a really strong, supportive figure in my journey.
I'm more in control of myself.
I'm kinder to myself.
I actually have that vision and a purpose.
I do feel like I'm a better version of myself already.
Amazing energy.
He was easy to talk to, which made me easy to trust him.
Working with Amrit at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and really I was bouncing out of bed.
Whenever I get off the calls with Amrit, best money we've ever spent.
I would not recommend him because I don't want everyone to know about him, and then I won't be able to book him. If he gets too busy, I won't get my turn.
I would say absolutely.
There's no way you can work with Amrit for a period of time without being transformed.
So if you're considering him as a coach, do not hesitate, because you won't be disappointed.
As you guys can see, there's a lot of people all over the world from all these different corners experiencing incredible transformations. I don't think, if I can say humbly myself, that there is anything quite like this somewhere else online. Most people that, you know, have channels that, you know, grow and grow and grow don't really focus on one-to-one offerings. I have just found that it is the most profound space where you can bring yourself in a private container and really just share what's going on for yourself. And if you want to book in for that call with me, touch base, it's www.amrit.coach/life. That's www.amrit.coach/life. There is a link in the show notes below to book in that call. And yeah, if you want to take your journey further, if you want to dive in deeper and you really want to live a spiritually aligned life, if it's for you, please do check it out. And without too much further ado, once again, for your spirit, for yourself, today's podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in to this amazing episode of The Inspired Evolution. Without you, The Inspired Evolution Tribe, this podcast would not be what it is today. Thank you so much for your love and your support. Thank you so much for being so inspired to evolve. It's truly inspiring. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to The Inspired Evolution on YouTube, the home of The Inspired Evolution's video podcast. We release inspiring conversations such as this every week, along with guided meditations and empowering insights, all designed to help you grow and evolve. Honestly, your subscription on YouTube to the channel helps us out a great deal. And one of the other benefits, if you're having any insights or shifts from these episodes that you want to chat about, or if you'd like to leave myself or the guest a message, please do so in the comments on YouTube. I truly look forward to hearing from you. And as always, Tribe, remember to stay inspired and keep evolving.